You're listening to the Unsigned Chat podcast. Hello everyone and a very warm welcome to episode 63 of the Unsigned Chat podcast with me, your host, Matt. It's another week, it's another show, and as usual, we have another guest lined up for you this week. So let's jump straight into it. This week, I'm pleased to welcome onto the podcast Andy, aka Coraland. So, Andy, how are you?
I'm very good, thanks.
So, for people that don't know anything about you, Andy, do you want to introduce yourself? Tell us a bit of a backstory to you.
Yeah, so my name's Andy, but I'm in a project called Coraland, which is a sort of name I came up with to distinguish myself from some other work I do online. I'm actually a meditation teacher of all things. So I thought I'd sort of separate those worlds. But yeah, I'm a singer-songwriter. I do producing as well, but I started out as a drummer. And I've got a very long story about that, which I won't maybe don't go into right now because I'll be here all day. But I started off with drums very young, and singing and songwriting is quite a new thing for me. So I'm a bit old now. I'm 43. I've been doing this for about 30 years, but I'm really enjoying my newfound love of writing songs and performing and all that sort of thing.
43 is never old, especially in music.
It's not. I've still got another good 50 years to go, I reckon.
I think 40s is the new 20, isn't it?
It is. I think it is. I think your best stuff comes in your 40s. They used to say, "Oh, you've done with it now in the 40s." But I definitely think I've got my best stuff's yet to come.
So, where does the name Coraland come from? Then you said actually you came up with the name Coraland. So, where does that come from? What's the meaning behind it?
So, I was trying to find a name. So, I came up with lots of different names. I was trying to find something that sort of didn't necessarily say anything too specific, but sounded sort of captured my music, really. And I was actually looking for a word with a sound. It sounds sort of strange, a sound I liked. And also, to be honest, something that's not been taken before. It's almost impossible. Every name you think of under the sun has already been taken on Spotify. So Coraland came out. I just love the way it sounded. I like the fact I don't want it to mean anything as such. I just like the sort of, it sort of captures what I'm sort of about, something not too sort of specific and concrete, but sort of evolving, if that makes sense, without sounding too pretentious. Yeah.
So what sort of music do you write? You know, what's your writing style?
So I'd say my music's quite sort of ambient pop with a little bit of a sort of an edge to it. Because I don't sort of comply with any sort of complete genre. So some of my songs are sort of electronic and they have quite a dance theme to them. Some I do live drums on and I've got more guitars and a bit more going on. But yeah, essentially it's ambient pop, dreamy pop music.
And you obviously got a single out at the moment, haven't you? Rocket Fuel.
That's right, yes. My single just came out in July. And that's one of my more electronic tracks that's got a bit of thump to it and sort of big chorus.
So what's the meaning behind Rocket Fuel then? What's that song about?
Rocket Fuel is actually about a time just after COVID where I was working from home a lot more. I sort of do work in mental health. I work in schools and things as well. And my work went online and I found I wasn't going out very much. And I got a sense of sort of agoraphobia or panic. I know lots of people have found that. I've never had that in my life, but I really found it hard going out. And I wrote Rocket Fuel to sort of capture that feeling of going out somewhere, even going out on a train and having that feeling of like, just that sort of overwhelm you feel and panic really and anxiety that sort of came. So I had to do a lot of work to sort of overcome this. And I wanted to capture that in Rocket Fuel, that idea. It's not actually about space. It's about going out of your comfort zone. But also trying to find where you belong as well. There's a few meanings in it about finding where you belong, but a lot of it's about sort of that moment when you feel like the ground's disappeared under your feet and all you want to do is kind of get back home quickly, and you know you've got to carry on, you've got to keep going. So that's sort of the theme.
And how long did it take you to write that song then?
It took a long time. I'm very, very perfectionist about music, and I it started off as a track you hear now, and then I went back and decided it should be a sort of more a laid back country song, with so I put guitars on it and violin and all sorts of stuff, and then I really didn't like that at all. I did a sort of Pet Shop Boys version. And then I did this
Okay.
horrible sort of ballad version where it started with guitars and went into this other thing. And it took a year. Eventually, I came back to full circle to the version I have now. And I've also only started singing a couple of years ago, but during lockdown, that sort of came with the songwriting. So I then had to get my voice up to speed to sing it because the chorus is actually quite hard to sing. So it took me a few attempts to record the vocals. And then finally, I got there through. Well, I was going to get a, try to get a producer to try and add a little bit more production. In the end, I did it myself because it's always better to do yourself in the end.
And so where does your love of music come from then? Are you from a musical family?
Yeah, well, my family, that no one's actually plays instruments really as such, but they love folk music actually. I used to go to folk festivals a lot when I was a kid, but I got some drums when I was, I got a snare drum when I was about 8 or 9, and I loved that thing. And finally got a drum kit when I was 11, and I was just obsessed with it. I'd literally sit there every morning, wait, because I wasn't allowed to play until 10 in the morning, and to sit there and I just sit and look at it till 10 o'clock, got to get up, you know, and just forget about breakfast and play and play and play. And then I started playing in bands when I was about 15, playing in pubs, or shouldn't have been probably. And then I sort of forgot about it a bit. And then when I was in my sort of late teens, sort of university time, I decided I didn't want to die being not being the best drummer I could be. So I got a loan out, career development loan, and got to went to move to London and did this drum school called Drum Tech, and honed my trade a bit with the idea of getting session work or getting in a band. This is a long story. I'll carry on if you want.
Go for it.
So I did the drum school for a year, really wonderful year. Lived in a house full of drummers, had a great time. It was my dream, just playing drums all day. And I stayed on after the course finished, and I got a job in a call center, as you do as a musician, and a bar as well. And I just started looking on like places. On sort of ads for bands and auditions. I got an audition for a cruise ship.
Okay.
I started rehearsals for that, and it fell through at the last minute. I'd given up my house, my room in the house, and given up my job, which was reading meters for Thames Water at the time. And then I saw this band on spot on MySpace that I really caught my ears, and they were based in Northampton. But there's something about them. I just thought this is better than the usual sort of demos I used to get through the post through CDs because we used to get CDs in those days. Used to get like 4 or 5 CDs through the door a week or something because I used to reply to every ad. So I went to Northampton to meet this band, and they were sort of full of usual stuff. Oh, we're going to have a manager and a label interest, and I thought, yeah, heard it all before. Anyway, it turns out they did. And I really liked the band so much, we all connected. So I moved out of London, quit my job, and went and slept on a guitarist's floor. 4 months later, we got signed to Parlophone, which is crazy. And so, you know, a whirlwind, you know, this is 2003. So we had the whirlwind of a success. So we got to do nice tours and things with the likes of the, we got to play with the Killers, believe it or not. When they released Mr. Brightside. So the second day of that tour, that was the day they released Mr. Brightside. So it's quite a bit of history, I guess, because that was such a big hit. Anyway, fast forward, blah, 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 blah. Eventually the band got dropped. I left and went back to London, joined a load of more bands, and carried on making music ever since, just playing in bands and things. But I could write about 4 books about what the next bit, so I won't go on too far because there's a lot of ins and outs.
No, it's fine. Obviously, you mentioned about
joining the band that got signed to Parlophone Records, did they know they were going to get signed to Parlophone, or did they just have the belief in themselves that they were going to one day be signed?
I think there was already a buzz about them right. when I joined, and they'd not been together for very long either, but they were all school friends, and they'd just written these bunch of demos. The story that I actually recently found out was the singer did some work experience at Parlophone, and then a couple of years later, he sort of contacted them. But the story is, I think they recorded three songs with a different drummer, and they called up all these record labels and just said, "We've got, you know, we've got all these meetings today. We can fit you in." Sort of, you know, he had a lot of confidence, and they said, "All right, we'll come and have a listen." And they brought one of these demo CDs. They only had one copy, so they had to take it back off the record label, you know, every time they went to visit, and they saw Parlophone, and then suddenly there's lots of labels after them. And I sort of joined a couple of weeks after that, really. But the drummer they had didn't want to be part of it. He was he was in a Christian band, and he really wanted to sort of honour that band, and that was his sort of chosen path. So lucky me, I got to sort of fill his shoes for that gig, and right time, right place, sort of happened.
And what was the name of the band then that was signed to the label?
They were called The Departure. And so you'll probably find it on YouTube. They had a song called All Mapped Out and one called All Arms Around Me as well. And we got a bit of MTV and Top of the Pops and a couple of computer game soundtracks as well. So that was quite nice.
Top of the Pops. Now that rings.
Yeah. Just before, I know. That's all, yeah. And that was, I think it wasn't the day, it was an evening show. It was like the Top of the Pops 2 or whatever it was.
So
I think it's when it was sort of winding down a little bit anyway, but still got on there. So that was nice.
What was it like being signed to the label then?
It was amazing. It was amazing. I mean, I was, you know, it was my dream. Ever since I was a kid, I wanted to be, you know, in a big band. That's all I wanted to do. So for the first, few weeks when it's all happening, I was sort of in this weird daydream. It sort of didn't feel like it was real, because we were going to all these meetings, fancy, you know, dinners, and you know, this was the time when labels had money, and and then, you know, we got this budget to buy kit, and I bought an amazing kit I had made in America and stuff, and everyone was sort of on a high. And then, you know, the tour, you know, just because it's a big label, you just get to do, there's obviously the pressure. So that was hard. But the tours we got, you know, we got put on really great tours, obviously like the Killers, we got to play with Feeder and support Duran Duran. And we got to play quite early on, probably after about 6 months, we supported Placebo at Wembley Arena, which was crazy. So it was it was sort of as you expect, you know, tour buses and just a lot of fun. And then that sort of wore off as the second album came, the difficult second album. Things turned a bit bitter, and we, like me and the bassist, got sort of taken out of the writing process, and then they got someone in to help them because they were struggling. And then, you know, it all sort of disbanded. And then, you know, we were doing it for 3 years, and then finally they got dropped because the second album got finished. I wasn't part of it in the end. But it was not released. They just deemed it not worthy of release. I think it was a lot of pressure for everyone. Was really young. The band hadn't been together long enough really to form a strong enough sort of writing. I don't know. I think everyone's just caught on the back foot. And so there it was, but it was an amazing experience. I'll never forget it. Obviously I'll still talk about it now, you know.
It's interesting how you'll talk about it as a fond memory.
It took me a while. Yeah, I mean, there was bitter times. I'll be, you know, we all sort of fell out a bit, sadly, and you know, some of us didn't speak for a long time, and it's sort of a cliche, and you sort of understand it now. But you know, looking back, it was amazing. I sort of wish I'd enjoyed it a bit more. You sort of feel like it's going to last forever when you're there and you get signed. Yeah, it was an enlightening experience. Because it sort of it gave me my dream early on, and it sort of made me question a lot of things in life, and it brought me into what I do now for a living, which is teach sort of meditation, and I write music for meditation as well. So it all had a meaning, it all had a sort of path there.
So like the last sort of year, 6 months of being signed to Parlophone Records, was there a sense that things were going to be coming to an end, you know, or was it all completely by surprise that?
Yeah, well, I'll tell you the full story. So they got a guy called Ed Buller in to help them write songs. He was in the Psychedelic Furs. So he came to the studio in Northampton, helped the singer write, and they started writing these sort of strange, totally different sort of sound, how what they had, which is, you know, that's all right. But the songs weren't really, I didn't think they were really coming together. But because me and the bassist had been sort of left out of the writing thing pretty much, and the other guitarist, I was just left at home. We couldn't go anywhere because we were still in the band, but we had nothing much to do. So it's quite depressing, actually. You've got nothing to fill your day, and you're not fulfilling yourself creatively because you're not part of something. Anyway, so one of the guitarists got asked to leave, unfortunately, for creative differences. Then I was asked to leave because I didn't turn up to it was a showcase for the label came over to listen to the latest songs. And I was really annoyed because I wasn't involved in it. So I thought, this shouldn't be the first time I hear these tracks, you know, with the label. And I sat in a pub and got drunk. And
fair enough.
Yeah, I was like, it all got bitter then anyway. And then we had a meeting and said, time for me to leave. And so I did. I sort of obviously absolutely devastated by it. But it was a good thing in the long term because I went back to London and joined another band. And yeah, and then they carried on. They finished the album, and then they got dropped by the label, and that was that. You know, that was, and they all sort of went their different ways, and yeah, that's, and the singer's still making music, he's still doing well, and I think one of the guitarists is doing some session work, and bass player is a radiologist. He's like pretty high up. Yeah, he's quite he's like a lecturer now. He was a clever guy. We used to sit talking about philosophy. We used to go out and party after the gigs. Well, me and the bassist, we used to sit and watch David Attenborough, Blue Planet, or talk about philosophy. We weren't really into it. I don't know why. I just didn't really like that whole world very much. But there you go. A bit geeky. So,
not so much party times, more intellectual conversations.
That's it. Yeah, we enjoyed that. Loved it. Kept us sane, so then, I think.
So what did you do after that band, then? You said you went on and you joined another band. What happened to that?
So I found another band, moved in with them, which is always a bad idea. And we lasted a couple of ideas. We did actually get a little bit of label interest. I don't know, it's a sort of time when Virgin sort of came over for a showcase and they decided we weren't to be. And I just darted around a few different bands. I tried some different things. There's like a folk outfit, and then there's someone on an artist management called ATC who I sort of did some percussion with. But meanwhile, I was doing all sorts of admin jobs, data entry, you name it. I've had a lot of jobs. And then I got into the charity sector, into fundraising for about 5 years amongst doing bands, but never made enough money. I never wanted to teach because I was self-taught. I didn't really know how to teach the drums. I just saying. So yeah, I got a little bit of session here and there, but nothing major. And I ended up sort of changing career paths. I sort of gave up on it. And I actually got into child and adolescent mental health, believe it or not. And I worked in a school for 6 years, a really amazing charity, which is no longer called Kids Company. And I managed a therapy service there and worked with kids, and really fulfilling. I got to see music and art and things like that. It ticked a lot of boxes. But in the background, I was always thinking about sort of music and how I'd jump back in there. But I was a little bit, by that point, I'd been in so many bands and so many things had sort of fallen apart or not worked out. And I was sort of quite happy to have a break from it. So yeah.
So if you fast forward your music career to Coraland, what's your plans with it? What do you want it to become? What's your goal for it?
I'm sort of quietly ambitious because I've always been ambitious in music. But I'm really enjoying sort of this new discovery because when I first wrote a song, it was completely by accident. I didn't know I could write a song, and I've sort of been learning to sing as part of that to try and bring it all together. But I'm hoping to play, you know, some sort of more meaningful shows, get a bit of a following. You know, I'm trying to get more tracks out. I've got a whole backlog of stuff to get out there, as a lot of people have. Well, sort of juggling, you know, my work and sort of keeping an income going, as you have to, you know, to sort of subsidize it at the moment. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I'm hoping to sort of find my sort of crowd. I think I've got a different, everyone says this, a sort of different sound. I think I've got someone that would people sort of connect with, or my message as well, you know, sort of. Yeah, so the most short term, play some more gigs, get some more experience. I need more experience in doing this. I'm much more comfortable behind a drum kit still. I need to like get there. I've got quite a complicated looper set up for my live show now, so I'm getting up to speed with that. In fact, I've got a gig next week, I should say that, on the 22nd of August, at Cat Space in London, near London Bridge. So do that. I would love to play some festivals. I've always enjoyed doing, like, you know, some festivals. And then I'm going to keep releasing and just see where this goes. That's the sort of short term.
And how many songs have you written today? Obviously, you said you've written some. So how many have you written so far?
I've got about 30 songs now. I've got a B-side list and I've got an A-list. Four more songs I've recently tracked in the studio. So I recorded all the drums and everything and the bass and vocals. I've just got to get on and mix it all. So yeah, I've got about another 6 or 7 tracks ready to sort of get finished and released. The process takes so long because, you know, just the production and the back and forth. But yeah.
And is your writing process the same for all the songs then that you write, or do you kind of have a different process for different songs?
They've all been different so far. I mean, I do predominantly write on guitar a lot of the time, and I normally hum something into my phone, which I know is quite common these days. Sometimes I've got this little cheap Yamaha thing with an arpeggiator on it, and that's spawned a few ideas, just playing around with some keyboard sounds. One of my first songs I wrote came from a little lullaby I made up for one of my kids trying to get him to sleep. And I was like, that sounds like a great melody. I'm taking that. And that became a song. So that was quite good. I was like, yes. But yeah, they're usually just little things that pop into my head. And I try and capture them as quickly as possible. And then I normally start production quite quickly. Just I go a bit crazy for a day and just throw everything at it. So it sounds like something I might want to listen to. And then I go back from there and try and think about structures.
And when you go to the studio, do you use the same studios, same producers, or do you like to sort of mix it up a bit and use different ones depending on sort of the sound you want from the music?
So I've used a couple so far. So I generally record everything at home where I can. And then I've used a studio in South East London, one in Perivale. Just as like an engineer sort of thing. So you just go along and they say, right, record, and off you go. And I recorded drums and bass and vocals. And then there's a great studio in Peckham called 123 Studios, a guy called Brett. Then I've recorded my last 4 songs there. And really amazing, amazing studio. He's had the likes of the Foles and Florence and the Machines in there. But he doesn't charge ridiculous amounts of money. He's just sort of really nice, honest, down-to-earth guy as well. So I've really enjoyed recording in those spaces, especially, you know, he's got a lovely drum kit in there, and it's quite a relaxed atmosphere. And there's a skateboarding club around the corner where my son can go to and try that out, although can't really do it at the same time. That doesn't really work.
I thought you wouldn't say you were the skateboarder.
No, I do skateboard, actually. That's why I want to think I do. I'm still, you know, in my 20s, as far as I'm concerned. I do, I can roll around, but I'm not so safe when it comes to doing drugs. That's broken bones territory.
That's fair enough. But yeah, I think it's always good, isn't it, if you can get a good studio, good producers.
Yeah, I think I find is to find someone that sort of cares about your music enough. And that's a strange, because, you know, lots of people working with different people all the time. And you really want to find someone that you sort of feel that they care about your music, and they're not just sort of going through the motions and going, yep, that's good. And you don't expect everyone to like your music or get what you're doing. That's fine. But just having that sort of care that you feel like, okay, they're going to go the extra mile and edit this properly. And that's the same for mixing as well. And it's taken me a while to find people that, you know, I really sort of can communicate with, and you know, get sort of find the best in the music as well.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? There's a lot of people who advertise for recording studios and producing work, but it's trying to find the ones that are really good at what they're doing.
Yeah, definitely. There's so, I mean, it's such a saturated place now. There's all these online for like platforms and places, and you can go anywhere. And I've actually Rocket Fuel I sent to someone who's got very good credits to his name. I really wanted someone to sort of finish the track off and give it the sparkle. And it came back, and I didn't think the vocal was that great anyway. And then he'd added some sort of bits of production that just sounded a bit lazy, and I sort of sensed that, you know, it just wasn't happening. So I had to still had to pay, you know, you still have to pay because it's their time, and you know, but I had to sort of part ways, and I just thought, oh, you know, that's not caring. And then I re luckily I decided my vocals weren't good enough and re-recorded it all and finished it myself. So I'm really glad that I did it myself. But you just a disappointment when you think someone, because I was a bit overwhelmed by finishing this one, and you just want someone to really care enough to go, actually, do you think you could do another vocal for the chorus there? Because I think that would be better. And but you know, it just thought, oh, that'll do. You know, if you're happy with it, I know that's, yeah, it should be my decision as well. But I don't know. You just sense that someone's not really giving putting their heart into it that much.
I think it's because you'll have a specific vision of how you want that song to be. And when you're just sending it off to somebody else, they've probably got that different vision of how they see the song. It's then
Yeah,
trying to marry the two up, isn't it, to
that's true. That's definitely a factor as well, of course. Like, you know, sometimes you've just got a different vision, and yeah, that's the hardest bit as well, to find someone that really sort of gets that sound. And some producers or mixers want to put their own mark on it and do their sort of version, and sometimes it's way out. And others are sort of more interested in just going with the sound that you've got, because a lot of what I, well, a lot of what I do is it's I start off with demos, but they usually sound sort of fairly finished pieces by the time I'm done with them, but I don't quite have the skills to like give that final polish. So you have to send it off, and then it all starts from scratch again, because obviously you have to send them all the clean sounds and everything. So sometimes I get frustrated by that, because you just think, oh, where's this going to go now? It's sort of starting all over again.
And where did you send them off to then when you did them?
So I've used a few different people. So I've there's a few websites that I've tried out, and I found a couple of really good mixers on those. There's one called Sound Better you might have heard of, and if you dig around, you can normally find, you know, someone who you think, oh, that, you know, you can have a little listen to what they've done as well. And the other two are recommendations from someone else I worked with. So I do, because I write ambient music as well. I've worked with a few different singers and sort of helped produce tracks for them. So I've used a few, like a couple of mixes there as well. So I've been quite lucky in finding recommended people too.
I think that's the thing, isn't it? Recommendation's key.
Yeah, oh, it's just so nice to have a stamp of approval, or just have an introduction, or yeah, it takes a little bit of the sort of complete unknown out of it. But yeah, the sort of, I've had a few like sort of lucky finds, and that's been great. And still, you know, you sort of build a relationship with that person, and it's nice you can mention them in your posts on social media and say, hey, you know, this guy's done my mix. And you know, although it should be more females in this world as well. Mix is always mixing guy, mixing sound guy should be, you're starting to see a few more mixing engineers who are female, which is good. But yeah, it's still male dominated, isn't it?
It is. I mean, luckily there is more and more females coming through, but yeah, it is still very male dominated. So with your music, what's your musical influences like? Who influenced your music kind of growing up? Who did you listen to?
So, I mean, it sort of started out with the sort of folk music, and that sort of the idea of sort of melodies leading everything. And I well, actually, when I was a kid, I actually had an interview with Dave Grohl. I heard an interview that he said he used to get two tape players and play something into one, and play that, and then play something over the top of it and record it with the other one. That's something I used to
Right.
do, which I thought was great. I was like, that's what I used to do with my keyboard and you know, a drum or something. But yeah, so my influences are sort of pretty mainstream stuff. Like I've always been interested in melody and stuff that really has sort of a bit of drama about it as well. So I was a big fan of Queen when I was younger. Bands like, you know, Fleetwood Mac, Dire Straits, things that have just got that sort of X factor about them, that sort of feel that it works as a whole. You know, Mike Knopfler is not the best singer in the world, but his sound and his guitar and the band all work. I have to admit, I'm a massive U2 fan as well. I've seen them about five times, and they're sort of the pinnacle of what I think, you know, a great band can be, sort of power, emotion, grit, melody, simplicity, all that sort of thing. I try to embody, always try and think the simplest like way in to a song without any fuss, without trying to show off. And other bands, and then I've had a lot of different sides, you know. I've sort of liked like quite a lot of heavier stuff. Like a big fan of Nine Inch Nails, actually. Again, for similar reasons, they've got this real cut-through sound. I've seen them a couple of times, and that rawness and that sort of emotion and that sort of drive, and it's just a unique thing. I remember when I was a kid asking my brother, like, I want more bands like Nine Inch Nails. Where can I find more music like this? And I never found anything, like any industrial rock that really ever sounded the same. That's amazing that, you know, Trent Reznor's come up with that sound himself. And yeah, so I've got quite an eclectic taste. I'll listen to anything, but I think it's something that's got to cut through with simplicity and melody and have a bit of a punch, I guess.
I'm guessing you're not a Swiftie then.
Well, I tell you what, off the radio, I've put myself in it, but I have slowly become a Swiftie.
Have you?
Yeah, since her Folklore album, that pricked up my ears because, I sort of, there's something about the album, and obviously it's produced by, I completely forgot his name. Oh, his name's gone. It'll come back anyway. But anyway, just the production of it. And she sort of went back to sort of rootsy sound. And I actually think she's, you know, you could say that her themes of her music and lyrically, you know, it's sort of about leaving boyfriends and finding boyfriends and all that sort of thing. But I think there's a depth to it that connects underneath that. Like, I think that's why she's insanely popular at the moment, because she's sort of speaking about essentially all her songs about not fitting in and not feeling like you belong. And I think anyone can connect with that, you know, regardless of whether you fit the character she creates. And then the music, I do love a bit of pop music. I think, I mean, you can't fault some of the production on those songs. And yeah, what I think, you know, she's a bit of a pioneer in what she's doing, I think, for as a female singer as well. I really sort of have a lot of respect for, you know, the way she's been able to change and transform herself. And I know some people be going, Taylor Swift, are you talking about? She, are you serious? And that's what I used to say. But I try and look a bit deeper at artists, and it's easy to say, oh yeah, she's a pop artist, da da da. She's got, you know, a sort of following, you know. But I think there's more to it that she tries to convey, more in her later stuff. I'm not, you know, some of it's a bit throwaway.
I like the fact though that obviously she had all that issue with owning her songs, so now she's re-releasing them as Taylor's version, which I think is quite a clever thing to do.
That's brave as well. I just thought, how do you she could do Taylor's version, it could completely be just nowhere near as good or not capture, you know, like when you demo a song, most often your vocal on that demo is the best thing you're ever going to do, and then you try and re-record it and you try and do, you know, put on the performance, and it never works. But I'm so impressed that she's managed to not only re-record those songs, but actually sort of give them a new life. And you know, they've stood up, because, yeah, it's quite an achievement, quite a brave thing to do.
It is. Yeah, it's a brave thing to do. But I think also what kind of helps her as well is obviously is because there's a story as to why she's doing it.
Yeah.
And a lot of the radio stations and the media are kind of saying, look, we'll only play Taylor's version of the songs going forward.
Yeah. It's quite empowering. Yeah.
They all seem to have got behind her with what she's doing and why she's doing it, which fair play to her. I did read the other day that she'd given all her truck drivers $100,000.
Wow.
Bonus for obviously a thank you for everything they've done for the tour.
There you go. Yeah, she seems like a good. She, her heart's in the right place as well, and I think she's been donating money to every city she's been going to, and you know she's clearly like wants to do something, you know, in the world. I mean, you can look at the other side of it. Like, you have to be a little bit crazy to want to do that sort of thing. You know, to be as big as that, and to be, you know, to do those kind of 3.5 hour shows, and for a long tour like that, you have to sort of a sort of superhuman, I think, to, you know, to be able to do that every night. And that's for all the musicians, I think, actually, like, you know, all the players, I just think they're all playing, working hard there as well. But
definitely.
Yeah.
So did you get tickets for it then?
No, I didn't actually. That was a step. I almost did. And I just thought, I can't do it. I can't. No, you save your money for something else. Almost. And I just thought, no, I don't think I'd enjoy it. Probably not. It's a little bit too much. I was quite happy. My sort of, you know, church sermon is going to see. I saw the U2 Joshua Tree tour. You know, the one they did a couple of years ago, the sort of reissue tour. That was amazing. That was like a spiritual experience seeing them do that. But yeah, that's when I'll leave.
Okay. Obviously, it's a bit of a difference there, then, isn't it, between Taylor and that sort of music?
There is, and there isn't. I think there's a sort of, I don't know, I think because what... Yeah, I think, well, I mean, what U2 do, you know, there's a sort of hardcore U2 fan base that will always be there, who know all the songs, who, you know, just find the whole thing, you know, sort of uniting, and, you know, everyone sings along. And they've sort of built that up as well, you know, through that, you know, what they stand for and their message. And you can say what you want about Bono. I know he's a controversial figure, and I understand why, absolutely. But yeah, I think that's these sort of stadium bands. The only way they can do that is to have that real sort of hardcore following that really sort of is more than just the music. They've bought into the whole thing. And yeah, so maybe there's a sort of similarity, and I guess you two have done quite a lot of pop stuff. I'm not a massive fan of their newer stuff, to be honest, but they've still got, you know, still got some relevance.
Do you find you get into the point now where you just think music's not as good as it used to be nowadays?
Unfortunately, I am. I'm stuck. My wife tells you I'm stuck in the 80s and 90s, which is quite true.
To be fair, they were the very good years of music.
They were brilliant years. I think obviously nostalgia plays a big part in all of this, but I think there was a sort of, I mean, I love the 80s, and the band Departure I played in, I happened to be all like influenced by the 80s massively. So I was really, it was right up my street being in that band. But yeah, and just great bands came out in the 90s. There's sort of an excitement, and there's still these sort of different scenes, and there's Britpop, and yeah, I think a lot of creativity happened. And then, you know, 2000s, you know, there was the sort of boom of bands, which was sort of part of guitar bands. But yeah, I am always on the lookout for new music, and I really wish I found, had better ways of finding it. I still struggle to really discover bands new bands to love, or there seems to be I don't know, it's because since I've been doing my own music and writing and connecting with other musicians and bands and things, you suddenly become aware there's a huge, you know, world and community out there. You know, a lot of it's online, but I do feel like something's sort of emerging a bit more, and there might be a rise of new sort of bands, or I don't know. I think
there is. Certainly online, there's more of a community for independent and unsigned artists.
Yeah, and like what you're doing, there's more people sort of giving a voice to independent artists as well, which is, I thank you for that. And, you know, Future Hits Radio as well sort of do
yes,
a lot to help. You know, they've played me a few times, which I've been really grateful for. And I think there's lots of people behind indie artists now because they know what it sort of takes, and we're sort of, you know, in a bit of a lost world in terms of there's not loads of support. It does cost a lot, you know, it does cost money to like sort of grow yourself, whether you're buying gear or just getting to gigs or having to, you know, just paying for making tracks and things. So
even studios are expensive.
Oh, it all adds up. I'm having to pause for a bit, actually, because I've spent too much money on the studio. I was so excited about recording these tracks. And, you know, I've gone, right, I've got to pause for a bit because you can't keep it up. But that's okay. It's good to have a sort of a breather and do some things that don't cost a lot of money. But, yeah, I think there seems the people are sort of rooting for independent musicians a bit more, and especially the ones that really sort of want to put the graft in and go, you know, give it their best shot, you know. And I think it's nice. I think I find that they're quite supportive. A few gigs I've done, you sort of get a sense of support there, so that's nice.
So what sort of gigs do you tend to do then, Andy?
So I've been hitting the open mic scene pretty hard the last year to get my singing and my sort of performance up a little bit, because I wrote all these songs I couldn't really sing live. I just couldn't get them. So I got some singing coaching from a really lovely singing teacher. And so my voice is now in sort of place. I feel like it's sort of doing the songs justice. And my live setup now, I was trying to find a band, actually. I really wanted to be in a band. Never found sort of enough people to work with or to do it. So I ended up going down the one man, Ed Sheeran, although I'm not a fan of Ed Sheeran, Looper extraordinaire. So I've spent a fortune on these pedals and things to loop, and I love it. I'm absolutely in my element, absolutely love messing about with stuff and making a sound. So I've created this sort of sound that's like the recordings, but not quite the same because there's so much production in to sort of take live, because I'm really not a fan of just a guitar and a vocal. I've got a lot of respect for people that, you know, singer-songwriters that do that, but I've never been excited by listening to just that. I do have a few songs I play with just an acoustic, but I always like a bigger thing, a bigger show, or, you know, something else going on.
I always think that a band is a lot more hard work because there's more people that you've got to please. There's more people that have got to be happy with what you're going to do. And there's a lot of people that go along with it for the ride and then go, actually, yeah, I'm not really into.
Yeah, there is that. I mean, I've had all sorts of bands. I've been kicked out of studios on New Year's Day. Like some studios south of London because the singer had an argument with the engineer. It's a totally different band. I've had all sorts of bizarre, you know, falling outs and living with them. And you end up with some bizarre situations. And I do miss the sort of camaraderie that you get with a band and the fact you're in it together and you've got someone to bounce off and you're sort of working towards a song together and you've got a vision. I really miss the ego chat where you're just, you do a rehearsal and you go out, sit outside for a bit and have a beer and you just speak yourselves up. Oh, we're just so good. This is just the greatest. Oh, you know, when they hear this show, there's no one in London doing this. Show. Every band does it. How good or bad they are. I really miss that. I loved it. We were just so convinced. The more beers we had, we're like, oh my goodness. So I've got lots of fun memories of being on, top of, like, there's a studio on top of this building. We sat on the roof, like, dancing around to our track. We just mixed on a phone. And, you know, that sort of thing I miss. So the solo thing's got, it's all your thing. And I really, sort of, you have control over what you do and gigs and your sound can really hone it in. But, there's something fun about being in bands and, you know, just being in it together. But yeah, it's hard to keep a band together and everyone's commitments change. And the last band I was in, sort of was a 3-piece electronic thing. We did the Isle of Wight Festival, which was quite a nice one. But then it was me. I just couldn't do it anymore with all the late nights. And I did it sort of as a session thing, unpaid, because I love the music anyway. And then it sort of disbanded from there. And, you know, that's the sort of part of doing music. But you do tire. I think maybe when you get a bit older of doing all the gigs in the week, I used to get a bit sort of coming back at 2 a.m, getting the bus home, and you'll go to work in your office the next day, and you just, oh, why am I doing this? Or especially if it's a bad gig, you carried all your gear. So there's a bit of that sort of, I don't miss that so much, but I've got a sort of new excitement about it at the moment. I'm really just enjoying doing anything. So it's good.
Have you played some bad gigs then?
Oh, well, where do I begin? We've done some sort of strange ones where the opening act was wearing this sort of fox's head and it was doing some bizarre sort of ambient thing that was And there's like there's one person there, and we sort of were playing at 10. I think we had to wait 2 hours to play. There's one where I wasn't allowed to play until I paid the promoter a fiver to use a drum kit. That was an interesting one. And we couldn't find him anywhere. And one of the guys you work with said, you can't go on yet until you've paid a fiver to use the drum kit. That was a bit of a drama. We've had a few with drunk singers. We've had plenty of drunk singer ones. But I've had some, you know, some really wonderful gigs, especially with, you know, the band Departure. We had some great times, and a lot. I mean, there's still a lot of, you know, when you're a new band, you still don't get sort of the big crowd going crazy sort of thing. There's a lot of it's just people standing watching you. You're like, do you like me? Do you like us? Do you like the music? Not sure. But some of the European festivals were a lot of fun. People sort of really got into it. And we did sort of play Japan and Australia, and Japan's a place where you first time you feel like a rock star because you're there's people waiting for you at the airport, fans and things, which is bizarre. So we had a bit of that.
How did you find that?
It's quite intimidating because in Japan apparently they try and steal your little thing, you know, try and break your little finger off to steal it as a sort of something to keep. Apparently I was told by a tour manager. But yes, yeah, that's another world in Japan. I mean, we weren't really known anywhere. So Europe weren't that big, but I think the label put up, we were on billboards and things in Japan. It's cliche to be popular in Japan. But yeah, it was a great, because we were doing all these big festivals and all the stars were around. Like, we had Slash came over to us in his hotel in Osaka and kind of chatted with us and things like that. It's like, wow, it's, you know, you've just sat in the same bar as us, just hanging out. And, you know, you can do your name drop chats. yeah, it was great. It was really sort of otherworldly, I'd say.
I think the thing with music is a lot of artists think, you know, if I had more money, I'd be more successful. But then you look at, obviously, artists that have been signed to record labels that pay for a lot of the stuff, and artists still don't necessarily become successful.
Yeah, definitely. You have to break. They have to break the artist, and you have to be on side with things like radio. Like Radio 1 weren't a big fan of our singer's voice, so we never got Radio 1 plays. At that time, like 2000s, I think there were little bags of money being handed around for different opportunities, and you know, you buy your way onto a good tour or whatever it is. Mm-hmm. But absolutely doesn't mean anything. Like we had a buzz about us because we were a new band, new signed to Parlophone, but we'd yet to prove ourselves. Really, it was just people sort of like, they think there's a buzz about a band, you start filling up, you know, venues. But we did mostly a lot of support slots. Then we did a couple of our own tours, which did well. But I know by the second album, and they did a tour there, you know, it was empty venues and things, I think, and that's it. And no amount of money can pay for a band unless they really got that sort of that authenticity, I think, that a band needs. Yeah. And the songs, you've got to have the songs. I still believe, I know lots of people say, oh, music's not, you know, you've got to have this sort of social media thing, and that's true, but I still believe I wouldn't want to do it unless it's about the music. And so as long as it's about the music for me, I don't care, and then I'll still do the other stuff. But
Do you think if your band had been more established then signed to Parlophone, things might have been different, or do you think the outcome would have still been the same?
Oh, good question. I don't know. I think possibly. I think because they'd not been together for that long, and the first batch of songs, I don't know if they're just in a creative space or something happened, or they just found, you know, they'd almost written some of the best songs before I joined. So I think I'm to blame. But no, we wrote a few good ones after that.
Is that what we're saying here?
Yeah, yeah. I ruined the band with my drumming. Totally my fault. That's why I left. Dear me. Now I'm thinking about it, it's kind of crashing down on me. I don't know. It's hard to know. I think I think everyone's pulling in different directions a bit. And I don't know. I think relationships as well in the band, I think that there's sort of everyone wanted to chip in. It's a real... so common in bands, you know, there's two people that sort of seen as a creative force, the labels sort of stick to them, and then the other players who have got a lot to offer don't always get noticed. But I understand why. Sometimes you need a vision to be seen through in one sort of way. So I think there's a lot of creative push and pull for a lot of bands, you know, especially when they get signed. They sort of want, you know, I mean, we did actually, they, you know, we did split royalties evenly, which was a nice thing, I thought, when we first signed. And that's, I still get royalties from that band. A good £15 every 4 months or something like that, maybe £9, which is quite amazing considering so long ago.
I hope you treat your wife to something nice.
That's it. Yep. Some tea bags, some nappies, something like that.
She must be truly grateful.
She is. She is. I hope she doesn't listen to this. Nothing. Nothing at all. So that's quite nice.
You mentioned earlier about being a meditation teacher. So how did you get into that line of work?
I got a bout of anxiety and depression after the band finished, and then X amount of bands later, and then I was working in the Royal Horse Cultural Society as a fundraiser, doing woodland appeals, and I'd lost it. Then I was like, this is just awful. You know, how am I going to get back to, you know, I'll never get back to this thing. So then I sort of discovered meditation. But just to backtrack, I discovered meditation when I was in the band, because I kind of lost hope in life, because I had my dream, and then when it started going downhill and I stopped enjoying it, I thought, well, what else is there now? I've literally got everything I wanted. So I sort of started going to this meditation group, and they were attached to this Buddhist center, and they used to send me cassette tapes that I'd listen to on a tour bus, which is bizarre. But so I started to learn sort of meditation through this Buddhist center, and then I got really into it, and it sort of kept me going through the sort of tough times with the band. But I was never really into the religious aspect of it, but more that sort of way you can calm your mind and you can see life in a different way. Anyway, so fast forward there, I sort of thought I'd get back into meditation as a way to help sort of mental health wise. And I really loved, I'd sort of learned mindfulness, which is sort of part of what Buddhism is really, but it's a bit more secular, a bit more sort of everyday sort of person stuff. I loved it, and I started learning to teach. So I did a course to teach it. And then I brought that to the kids I used to work with in this charity in the school. And it was at one of the trainings, someone mentioned an app called Insight Timer, which is a really great app that offers free meditations. You can put stuff up there and it's just free. Anyway, I put some recordings up there that I used to give out to the groups I used to teach. And they got really popular. And the app sort of carried on for about 5 years, and I got to sort of know them a little bit. But they didn't monetize it, so I wasn't making any money. And finally, they decided to, you know, find a way to monetize it to make it work, so they didn't lose their community on the app. And then I started to sort of make a bit of an income from that. And then meanwhile, I did some things with some publishers because I got a bit of popularity from that as well. So I wrote, my idea was to write music for guided meditation that wasn't really cheesy and horrible like you'd expect. So I started to try and put real instruments in. So I bought a violin. I didn't have to play violin, but I bought one, and I just learned it enough to play a few notes on it. And now, you know, I get hired to do violin for stuff. But I bought this violin, a left-handed one, which you can't really get anywhere. So I had to go and get one made, and started to just try and do some orchestral stuff and sort of synthy recordings. Anyway, it went down really well. And I just got more and more followers, and then they monetized it, and I wrote some courses, and then gradually my income built from that. And then I did some teaching, and I worked in schools, working with this group doing well-being. So I was sort of the mindfulness lead on that. And now I've got 120,000 followers on this app, and I've had about 6 million plays of my guided meditations and music. And so that's sort of my living now, which is amazing. I'm really lucky to be able to do that.
That's fantastic.
I was doing more work in schools. Since COVID, a lot of my schools were stopped. A lot of funding was, you know, difficult to get for working with the kids. So I ended up fundraising a few times for schools. I was in local schools trying to get money to pay for my role, which was really frustrating. And in the end, I had to sort of call it. But so now I write courses and things, and originally it was going to be for musicians. Actually, I'd I bought the domain name Mindfulness for Musicians because I had tinnitus. I still got tinnitus. And I was going to do it for musicians who were sort of struggling, mental health, tinnitus, anything like that. But my brother told me that was a bit too sort of niche. So I sort of expanded it to just mindfulness for anyone. So yeah. And then through my group, weirdly, there was an event in Cambridge with the Dalai Lama. It's like a sort of a summit thing. And my little group was invited to introduce him. So I got to introduce the Dalai Lama to a group. We were doing sort of discussions, all these sort of poets and world leaders came over for it. And yeah, it's weird. I had a weird old life. But yeah.
It seems a very vast one.
Yeah. I tend to say yes to anything. I would try anything once, including I worked at a friend's bike shop. Never built a bike before, and I got quite good at it because I'd had enough of fundraising at the time, and I built a bike for the guy who owns WeTransfer, you know, that file sharing website. Yeah. So he came in, he wanted a branded bike, so we used to do branded bikes, so we got stickers and things, made one for him, and as part of that I got on the front cover of London Cyclist magazine. Not really a massive cyclist. yeah, I ended up with some weird sort of situations and things. And this is what excites me, like just doing things, just saying I'll do it, like music, writing music. And, you know, my wife thinks I've gone mad writing songs and going out doing gigs and things when I've got kids and whatnot. But I just think that's what life's about. What's the point in just going, yeah, that'll do? It's like there's always something exciting around the corner. So
completely agree. Sometimes yeah. The excitement is the unknown.
Yeah, that's it. You don't know. I think as I got older, I don't care as much about whether it's going well or not. I mean, if I do a gig, I want it to be, you know, a great gig. But it doesn't hit you quite as hard, I don't think, as in your 20s. You're like, well, that's interesting. I've learned something there. I'll try this next time. You know, or maybe it'll lead me to do more production stuff, or maybe the scene's just a way to something else. I don't know, but I'm really just enjoying that.
They always say adventure starts at the end of your comfort zone.
That's it. It's definitely the end of my comfort zone because, yeah, as I said earlier, I'd much rather have a big fortress of drums around me at a gig than standing by a mic with a guitar. But I do enjoy, you know, once you're up there and you're doing your thing and, you know, to sing your own music, whether it's to two people or to a dog, is great.
So if you could bring back any band, who would you bring back to form like a super group?
Ooh, that's a tough one. There was a band I was in called the Six Toes, and they were sort of a really dark sort of Nick Cave-esque thing, and I was playing sort of more brushes and things, but they had really interesting melodies and things, and they had like violins and cello, and I always thought they were on their way to something a bit, you know, a bit more sort of a bit different, but they actually split up in the end. But you can find their music still, Six Toes. There's a song they've got called Trick of the Night. It's a great tune. But yeah, I wouldn't bring the departure back. Dust, there's too much bitterness. So, like, quite honest, I don't think anyone would want to be that, join that, start that band again. There's another band that was called the Serotones, which was the band I joined after that. And, you know, there's the singer there. He's gone on, he's in a rock band called the Duskoder, which are great sort of proper full-on Guns N' Roses meets Soundgarden sort of band. And they just supported Guns N' Roses at Hyde Park, which is amazing because this guy, he's worked harder than anyone I know in the music, you know, in music, and not really got any breaks. You know, he's a great singer, really phenomenal voice. So nice to see someone sort of find their band, find their sound, find what they want to do, and it sort of happens for them.
And which six celebrities would you like to go out for a pint with?
Ooh, six celebrities.
There could be anybody, dead or alive.
Oh, right, here we go. So I definitely like to go out and have a good old chat with Peter Gabriel. I think he's an interesting character. He's sort of not sort of conventional thinker. Kate Bush, 100%. That'd be amazing. I'd have to include Bono, but I'd probably get annoyed with him after a while. I'd be disappointed. Really disappointed. If I had a thing about the celebrities I did meet, I found everyone smaller than I thought they would be. It was like going to a toy shop every time I met someone. I was like, oh, you're small as well. Is anyone like a normal size? Bizarre experience that was.
You're quite tall then, Andy.
Oh, no, I'm not really, but I just, everyone just seemed to be quite small. Like all these like front men and things. I'm just really surprised. You always expect them to be really tall. Who else would I like to meet? So I've got three more, haven't I? I think I'd probably... I mean, someone like a painter or something, like probably Kandinsky or something like that. Just for a sort of different experience. My mind's gone blank now. David Bowie. I think that's got to be, you've got to have David Bowie on the list because he's just a fascinating character. And last but not least, Bouncer from Neighbours, RIP. You know, would have loved to know what it was like on set. In the 80s, sorry, that's a terrible one. Just popped into my head, so I thought I'd say it.
I mean, Neighbours is coming back, isn't it?
It is. It's come, yeah, I think it's been taken over again by maybe, is it Amazon or Netflix or something?
Amazon, yeah. Is it Freevee or something? Because
yeah, that's it. That's
yeah,
it.
It's coming back.
I was a fan in the 80s, but...
So if anybody wants guaranteed sunshine, watch Neighbours.
Yeah, exactly. That's it. That cheer everyone up. Brilliant.
It's where you go if you want a bit of sunshine, isn't it? Watch
it
Neighbours.
It is. It's like a nice, blissful sort of escapism.
Watch Emmerdale for a bit of country fresh air.
That's it, yeah. Watch EastEnders if you want to like get really worked up and angry.
Yeah. Yeah. EastEnders is a bit like that, isn't it?
It is. It just, yeah. I lots of people love it, but it always used to make me just feel a bit sad about life. It's just so bitter. Just like the brunt of like the worst things always happen all the whole time.
It was pretty good for reverse psychology because you watch it and then think, you know, my life's not that bad after all.
Yeah, that's true. I guess that was the draw, wasn't it? Things like that and Casualty, people used to watch that like, oh, well, it could be worse. It could be, you know, in a hospital.
Casualty, yeah. Is that still on?
I think that's stopped now. I'm pretty sure. Yeah, no, that's had its day. We've got TikTok now. TikTok now for all our needs of, you know, what other people are doing in the world.
I'd be surprised if there's not sort of some little mini TV show that appears on TikTok.
Probably. I'm sure someone must have thought of that now, but has anyone got the attention span for a TV show that's longer than 30 seconds long? That's the question.
Because they used to do short ones on... like YouTube, didn't they, which were like 15 minutes?
Oh, yeah, they did actually, didn't they? Yeah, there's quite successful ones as well, some of those YouTubers. I don't know if YouTubers are still a thing, if they're still like, still billionaire people, but who knows? I'm out of touch now, I feel out of touch. But I'm sure YouTubers... I had a friend actually who managed YouTubers who worked for a company that sort of did it, and he got a little insight into that crazy world. Just, you know, the amount of money they make from all their merch and, you know, just it's bonkers. They don't know what to do with it.
If I had that much money, I'd buy a yacht.
Exactly. You'd buy a yacht and stay on it and just not ever watch the news again. You'd be happy.
True. So where can people find you online then, Andy? Where do you hang out socially?
So I'm mostly on Instagram. So it's just at Coraland_. And I'm also on TikTok. I'm trying to be better on these things. I've gone back on Facebook, regrettably. I'm there as well. But yeah, TikTok and Instagram are good. And then I've got a website as well. But that basically leads you back to TikTok website. So you're just going to be going in circles. So yeah, to find out the sort of latest stuff, I think Instagram and TikTok.
Are you not on Twitter or X, as it's known now?
I am. I was on Twitter. I left that. Now I'm on Threads. I have no idea what to do with Threads anymore. So I'm just in limbo with those two. I did do it for my sort of meditation teaching Twitter, but I got a bit caught up in all the negativity, and I got a bit. You end up not only posting, you obviously read stuff, and like it was around Brexit, and I started getting too obsessed with all the politics of it all, and my wife told me I needed to stop looking at Twitter, so I did. I listened to her,
and it helped.
It did help. I know. I got way too, you know, you get in your little bubble, and it just makes you angry, even if you know what people are saying is perfectly reasonable. So I thought that's not good. Let's move on.
It'd be interesting to see what happens with Twitter, though, because obviously he's rebranded it X, hasn't he? And he wants to make it into like a big super app that basically does everything.
Yeah, so, I'm intrigued. So I mean, I think Threads, I don't know if it'll happen now because everyone joined it because they should. But Elon Musk has always got a plan there. You think, this is going to go wrong. But I always feel like he's got some sort of underlying plan that might work out. But he's sort of monetizing a lot of it as well, like getting your blue tick and whatnot. So I'm not sure how that's going to go down. We'll see. I'm not sure. He must be losing numbers now.
Well, I know the ad revenue on Twitter was well down.
Oh, really? Yeah. There's it unstable.
A lot of brands that kind of left.
Yeah, I think it's that instability of it at the moment because people don't really know what's going to be next and what kind of, you know, the fact he's rebranded X is quite a bold move as well. I think
he's trying to arrange a cage fight, isn't he, with Zuckerberg?
I think the latest I heard about that, and not that I'm following it too closely, but is that Elon Musk won't agree on a location and date, and I think Zuckerberg said, you know, he's
ready. It was his idea, apparently.
Yeah, I know. It's bizarre. I'd love to see it. I mean, wouldn't it be a surreal thing with all the stuff going on in the world right now to have that happen? Would just be the cherry on the cake for just utter madness.
I think Zuckerberg would win.
Yeah, I think he would, actually. I think he's got the sort of... I think he's a robot as well, so he's probably got more strength than we think.
He does quite a lot of like cage fighting and whatnot, doesn't he, apparently?
Yeah, he seems very confident. And I think Elon Musk is, I don't think he's the fittest. Yeah, I think I put my money on Zuckerberg as well. I think you're right there.
But it'll be interesting to see what happens with those two, whether they actually do have a cage fight or whether it'll just be all talk.
Yeah, it might fizzle out now. I'm not sure. They need to get their date in there, and you know they could fund a lot of things. If they did it for charity or something, that'd be quite good. And then
if they live streamed it on X and also live streamed it on Facebook, think of the audience numbers you'd get.
Ah, oh, there you go. That would be it. It'd be sort of scratching each other's back. You know, no hard feelings. That would blow up, wouldn't it? Blow up the internet.
Crazy world.
Yeah, it is.
Well, Andy, it's been absolutely fantastic speaking with you.
Oh, thanks, Matt. No, thanks for sort of hearing my long stories and my woes of being a musician.
No, it's been very insightful to hear your stories of what you've been doing and what it was like to be signed to a label.
Yeah, I guess it's a rare thing now for that to happen, more so, I guess. I mean, it's still a rare thing then, but the labels don't have all that money anymore, and well, they do, but not to spend in sort of those ways. So yeah, it was a real like unusual experience, and yeah, well, I'll never forget it, that's for sure.
Well, fingers crossed you get signed to another label.
Who knows, this could be it. Another one comes knocking at the door and I'll say, how much have I got to pay you for this?
Thank you so much for being on the podcast.
All right, thanks, Matt.
That's all we've got time for this week. A big thank you to our guest, Andy, and a big thanks to you guys for listening. Until next time, have a great week.